immune to the psychologist's hypnotic suggestions. They had made me into a kind of conspirator against her. Even if her purposes were benign, I felt a wave of anxiety whenever I thought of confessing that I was resistant to hypnosis, especially since it meant any underlying conditioning hidden in our training also was affecting me less and less. I now hid not one but two secrets, and that meant I was steadily, irrevocably, becoming estranged from the expedition and its purpose. Estrangement in all its many forms was nothing new for these missions. I understood this from having been given an opportunity along with the others to view videotape of the re-entry interviews with the members of the 11th Expedition. Once those individuals had been identified as having returned to their former lives, they were quarantined and questioned about their experiences. Reasonably enough, in most cases, family members had called the authorities, finding their loved ones' return uncanny or frightening. Any papers found on these returnees had been confiscated by our superiors for examination and study. This information, too, we were allowed to see. The interviews were fairly short, and in them all 8 expedition members told the same story. They had experienced no unusual phenomena while in Area X, taken no unusual readings, and reported no unusual internal conflicts. But after a period of time, each one of them had had the intense desire to return home and had set out to do so. None of them could explain how they had managed to come back across the border or why they had gone straight home instead of first reporting to their superiors. One by one, they had simply abandoned the expedition, left their journals behind, and drifted home somehow. Throughout these interviews, their expressions were friendly and their gazes direct. If their words seemed a little flat, then this went with the kind of general calm, the almost dreamlike demeanor each had returned with. Even the compact, wiry man who had served as the expedition's military expert, a person who'd had a mercurial and energetic personality. In terms of their affect, I could not tell any of the 8 apart. I had the sense that they now saw the world through a kind of veil, that they spoke to their interviewers from across a vast distance in time and space. As for the papers, they proved to be sketches of landscapes within Area X, or brief descriptions. Some were cartoons of animals or caricatures of fellow expedition members. All of them had, at some point, drawn the lighthouse or written about it. Looking for hidden meaning in these papers was the same as looking for hidden meaning in the natural world around us. If it existed, it could be activated only by the eye of the beholder. At the time, I was seeking oblivion, and I sought in those blank, anonymous faces, even the most painfully familiar, a kind of benign escape, a death that would not mean being dead. 2. Integration. In the morning, I woke with my senses heightened, so that even the rough brown bark of the pines or the ordinary lunging swoop of the woodpecker came to me as a kind of minor revelation. The lingering fatigue from the 4-day hike to base camp had left me. Was this some side effect of the spores, or just the result of a good night's sleep? I felt so refreshed that I didn't really care. But my reverie was soon tempered by disastrous news. The anthropologist was gone, her tent empty of her personal effects. Worse, in my view, the psychologist seemed shaken, and as if she hadn't slept. She was squinting oddly, her hair more wind-blown than usual. I noticed dirt caked on the sides of her boots. She was favoring her right side, as if she had been injured. "Where is the anthropologist?" the surveyor demanded, while I hung back, trying to make my own sense of it. "What have you done with the anthropologist?" was my unspoken question, which I knew was unfair. The psychologist was no different than she had been before. That I knew the secret to her magician's show did not necessarily mean she was a threat. The psychologist stepped into our rising panic with a strange assertion. I talked to her late last night. What she saw in that structure unnerved her to the point that she did not want to continue with this expedition. She has started back to the border to await extraction. She took a partial report with her so that our superiors will know our progress. The psychologist's habit of allowing a slim smile to cross her face at inappropriate times made me want to slap her.
But she left her gear, her gun, too, the surveyor said.
She took only what she needed, so we would have more, including an extra gun. Do you think we need an extra gun? I asked the psychologist. I was truly curious. In some ways, I found the psychologist as fascinating as the tower, her motivations, her reasons. Why not resort to hypnosis now? Perhaps even with our underlying conditioning, some things are not suggestible, or fade with repetition, or she lacked the stamina for it after the events of the night before.
I think we don't know what we need, the psychologist said, but we definitely did not need the anthropologist here if she was unable to do her job.
The surveyor and I stared at the psychologist. The surveyor's arms were crossed. We had been trained to keep a close watch on our colleagues for signs of sudden mental stress or dysfunction. She was probably thinking what I was thinking. We had a choice now. We could accept the psychologist's explanation for the anthropologist's disappearance or reject it. If we rejected it, then we were saying the psychologist had lied to us and therefore also rejecting her authority at a critical time. And if we tried to follow the trail back home, hoping to catch up with the anthropologist to verify the psychologist's story, would we have the will to return to base camp afterward?
We should continue with our plan, the psychologist said. We should investigate the tower.
The word tower in this context felt like a blatant plea for my loyalty. Still, the surveyor wavered, as if fighting the psychologist's suggestion from the night before. This alarmed me in another way. I was not going to leave Area X before investigating the tower. This fact was ingrained in every part of me, and in that context, I could not bear to think of losing another member of the team so soon, leaving me alone with the psychologist. Not when I was unsure of her, and not when I still had no idea of the effects of my exposure to the spores.
She's right, I said. We should continue with the mission. We can make do without the anthropologist.
But my pointed stare at the surveyor made it clear to both of them that we would revisit the issue of the anthropologist later. The surveyor gave a surly nod and looked away. The audible sigh of either relief or exhaustion came from the psychologist.
That's settled then, she said, and brushed past the surveyor to start making breakfast. The anthropologist had always made breakfast before.
At the tower, the situation changed yet again. The surveyor and I had readied light packs with enough food and water to spend the full day down there. We both had our weapons. We both had donned our breathing masks to keep out the spores, even though it was too late for me. We both wore hard hats with fixed beams on them. But the psychologist stood on the grass just beyond the circle of the tower, slightly below us, and said, "I'll stand guard here."
"Against what?" I asked, incredulous. I did not want to let the psychologist out of my sight. I wanted her embedded in the risk of the exploration, not standing at the top with all of the power over us implied by that position. The surveyor wasn't happy either. In an almost pleading way that suggested a high level of suppressed stress, she said, "You're supposed to come with us. It's safer with three."
"But you need to know that the entrance is secured," the psychologist said, sliding a magazine into her handgun. The harsh scraping sound echoed more than I would have thought. The surveyor's grip on her assault rifle tightened until I could see her knuckles whiten.
"You need to come down with us. There's no reward in the risk of all of us going down," the psychologist said, and from the inflection I recognized a hypnotic command. The surveyor's grip on her rifle loosened. The features of her face became somehow indistinct for a moment.
"You're right," the surveyor said. "Of course you're right. Makes perfect sense."
A twinge of fear traveled down my back. Now it was 2-1. I thought about that for a moment, took in the full measure of the psychologist's stare as she focused her attention on me. Nightmarish, paranoid scenarios came to me, returning to find the entrance blocked or the psychologist picking us off as we reached for the open sky, except she could have killed us in our sleep any night of the week.
"It's not that important," I said after a moment. "You're as valuable to us up here as down there."
And so we descended, as before, under the psychologist's watchful eye. The first thing I noticed on the staging level before we reached the wider staircase that spiraled down, before we encountered again the words written on the wall, the tower was breathing. The tower breathed, and the walls, when I went to touch them, carried the echo of a heartbeat. And they were not made of stone, but of living tissue. Those walls were still blank, but a kind of silvery white phosphorescence rose off of them. The world seemed to lurch, and I sat down heavily next to the wall, and the surveyor was by my side, trying to help me up. I think I was shaking as I finally stood. I don't know if I can convey the enormity of that moment in words. The tower was a living creature of some sort. We were descending into an organism.
"What's wrong?" the surveyor was asking me, voice muffled through her mask. "What happened?"
I grabbed her hand, forced her palm against the wall.
"Let me go!"
She tried to pull away, but I kept her there. "Do you feel that?" I asked, unrelenting. "Can you feel that?"
"Feel what? What are you talking about?"
She was scared, of course. To her, I was acting irrationally. Still, I persisted. A vibration, a kind of beat. I removed my hand from hers, stepped back. The surveyor took a long, deep breath and kept her hand on the wall.
"No. Maybe. No. No, nothing."
"What about the wall? What is it made of?"
"Stone, of course," she said.
In the arc of my helmet flashlight, her shadowed face was hollowed out, her eyes large and circled by darkness, the mask making it look like she had no nose or mouth. I took a deep breath. I wanted it all to spill out, that I had been contaminated, that the psychologist was hypnotizing us far more than we might have suspected, that the walls were made of living tissue. But I didn't. Instead, I got my shit together, as my husband used to say. I got my shit together because we were going to go forward and the surveyor couldn't see what I saw, couldn't experience what I was experiencing, and I couldn't make her see it.
"Forget it," I said. I became disoriented for a second. "Look, we should go back up now. You're panicking," the surveyor said.
We had all been told we might see things that weren't there while in Area X. I know she was thinking that this had happened to me. I held up the black box on my belt.
"Nope, it's not flashing. We're good."
It was a joke, a feeble joke, but still.
"You saw something that wasn't there."
She wasn't going to let me off the hook. "You can't see what is there," I thought. "Maybe," I admitted. "But isn't that important, too? Isn't that part of all of this? The reporting? And something I see that you don't might be important." The surveyor weighed that for a moment.
"How do you feel now?"
"I feel fine," I lied. "I don't see anything now," I lied. My heart felt like an animal had become trapped in my chest and was trying to crawl out. The surveyor was now surrounded by a corona of the white phosphorescence from the walls. Nothing was receding. Nothing was leaving me.
"Then we'll go on," the surveyor said, "but only if you promise to tell me if you see anything unusual again."
I almost laughed at that, I remember.
Unusual?
Like strange words on a wall, written among tiny communities of creatures of unknown origin?
I promise, I said. And you will do the same for me, right?
Turning the tables, making her realize it might happen to her, too.
She said, just don't touch me again, or I'll hurt you.
I nodded in agreement. She didn't like knowing I was physically stronger than her. Under the terms of that flawed agreement, we proceeded to the stairs and into the gullet of the tower, the depths now revealing themselves in a kind of ongoing horror show of such beauty and biodiversity that I could not fully take it all in. But I tried, just as I had always tried, even from the very beginning of my career.
My lodestone, the place I always thought of when people asked me why I became a biologist, was the overgrown swimming pool in the backyard of the rented house where I grew up. My mother was an overwrought artist who achieved some success but was a little too fond of alcohol and always struggled to find new clients, while my dad, the underemployed accountant, specialized in schemes to get rich quick that usually brought in nothing. Neither of them seemed to possess the ability to focus on one thing for any length of time. Sometimes it felt as if I had been placed with a family rather than born into one. They did not have the will or inclination to clean the kidney-shaped pool, even though it was fairly small. Soon after we moved in, the grass around its edges grew long. Sedge weeds and other towering plants became prevalent. The short bushes lining the fence around the pool lunged up to obscure the chain link. Moss grew in the cracks in the tile path that circled it. The water level slowly rose, fed by the rain, and the surface became more and more brackish with algae. Dragonflies continually scouted the area. Bullfrogs moved in, the wriggling, malformed dots of their tadpoles always present. Water gliders and aquatic beetles began to make the place their own. Rather than get rid of my 30-gallon freshwater aquarium, as my parents wanted, I dumped the fish into the pool, and some survived the shock of that. Local birds, like herons and egrets, began to appear, drawn by the frogs and fish and insects. By some miracle, too, small turtles began to live in the pool, although I had no idea how they had gotten there. Within months of our arrival, the pool had become a functioning ecosystem. I would slowly enter through the creaking wooden gate and observe it all from a rusty lawn chair I had set up in a far corner. Despite a strong and well-founded fear of drowning, I had always loved being around bodies of water. Inside the house, my parents did whatever banal, messy things people in the human world usually did, some of it loudly. But I could easily lose myself in the micro-world of the pool. Inevitably, my focus, netted from my parents' useless lectures of worry over my chronic introversion, as if by doing so they could convince me they were still in charge. I didn't have enough or any friends, they reminded me. I didn't seem to make the effort. I could be earning money from a part-time job, but when I told them that several times, like a reluctant antlion, I had had to hide from bullies at the bottom of the gravel pits that lay amid the abandoned fields beyond the school, they had no answers. Nor when one day, for no reason, I punched a fellow student in the face when she said hello to me in the lunch line. So we proceeded, locked into our separate imperatives. They had their lives, and I had mine. I liked most of all pretending to be a biologist, and pretending often leads to becoming a reasonable facsimile of what you mimic, even if only from a distance. I wrote down my pool observations in several journals. I knew each individual frog from the next, old Flopper, so much different from ugly Leaper, and during which month I could expect the grass to teem with hopping juveniles. I knew which species of heron turned up year-round and which were migrants. The beetles and dragonflies were harder to identify, their life cycles harder to intuit, but I still diligently tried to understand them. In all of this, I eschewed books on ecology or biology. I wanted to discover the information on my own first. As far as I was concerned, an only child, and an expert in the uses of solitude, my observations of this miniature paradise could have continued forever. I even jury-rigged a waterproof light to a waterproof camera and planned to submerge the contraption beneath the dark surface to snap pictures using a long wire attached to the camera button. I have no idea if it would have worked, because suddenly I didn't have the luxury of time. Our luck ran out, and we couldn't afford the rent anymore. We moved to a tiny apartment, stuffed full of my mother's paintings, which all resembled wallpaper to me. One of the great traumas of my life was worrying about the pool. Would the new owners see the beauty and the importance of leaving it as is, or would they destroy it, create unthinking slaughter in honor of the pool's real function? I never found out. I couldn't bear to go back, even if I also could never forget the richness of that place. All I could do was look forward, apply what I had learned from watching the inhabitants of the pool. And I never did look back, for better or worse. If funding for a project ran out, or the area we studied was suddenly bought for development, I never returned. There are certain kinds of deaths that one should not be expected to relive, certain kinds of connections so deep that when they are broken you feel the snap of the link inside you. As we descended into the tower, I felt again, for the first time in a long time, the flush of discovery I had experienced as a child. But I also kept waiting for the snap. Where lies the strangling fruit that came from the hand of the sinner? I shall bring forth the seeds of the dead to share with the worms that... The tower steps kept revealing themselves, those whitish steps, like the spiraling teeth of some unfathomable beast, and we kept descending because there seemed to be no choice. I wished at times for the blinkered seeing of the surveyor. I knew now why the psychologist had sheltered us, and I wondered how she withstood it, for she had no one to shield her from anything. At first, there were merely the words, and that was enough. They occurred always at roughly the same level against the left-hand side of the wall, and for a time I tried to record them, but there were too many of them, and the sense of them came and went, so that to follow the meaning of the words was to follow a trail of deception. That was one agreement the surveyor and I came to right away, that we would document the physicality of the words, but that it would require a separate mission another day to photograph that continuous, never-ending sentence. To share with the worms that gather in the darkness and surround the world with the power of their lives, while from the dim-lit halls of other places, forms that never could be writhe for the impatience of the few who have never seen or been seen. The sense of unease in ignoring the ominous quality of those words was palpable. It infected our own sentences when we spoke, as we tried to catalogue the biological reality of what we were both seeing. Either the psychologist wanted us to see the words and how they were written, or simply suppressing the physical reality of the tower's walls was a monumental and exhausting task. These things, too, we experienced together during our initial descent into the darkness. The air became cooler, but also damp, and with the drop in temperature came a kind of gentle sweetness, as of a muted nectar. We also both saw the tiny hand-shaped creatures that lived among the words. The ceilings were higher than we would have guessed, and by the light of our helmets as we looked up, the surveyor could see glints and whirls as of the trails of snails or slugs. Little tufts of moss or lichen dotted that ceiling, and exhibiting great tensile strength, tiny long-limbed translucent creatures that resembled cave shrimp stilt walked there as well. Things only I could see, that the walls minutely rose and fell with the tower's breathing,
that the colors of the words shifted in a rippling effect, like the strobing of a squid, that with a variation of about 3 inches above the current words and 3 inches below, there existed a ghosting of prior words, written in the same cursive script. Effectively, these layers of words formed a watermark, for they were just an impression against the wall, a pale hint of green or sometimes purple, the only sign that once they might have been raised letters. Most seemed to repeat the main thread, but some did not. For a time, while the surveyor took photographic samples of the living words, I read the phantom words to see how they might deviate. It was hard to read them. There were several overlapping strands that started and stopped and started up again. I easily lost track of individual words and phrases. The number of such ghost scripts faded into the wall suggested this process had been ongoing for a long time, although without some sense of the length of each cycle, I could not give even a rough estimate in years. There was another element to the communications on the wall, too. One I wasn't sure if the surveyor could see or not. I decided to test her. "Do you recognize this?" I asked the surveyor, pointing to a kind of interlocking lattice work that at first I hadn't even realized was a pattern, but that covered the wall from just below the phantom script to just above them, the main strand roughly in the middle. It vaguely resembled scorpions strung end to end, arising, only to be subsumed again. I didn't even know if I was looking at a language per se. It could have been a decorative pattern, for all I knew. Much to my relief, she could see it. "No, I don't recognize it," she said. "But I'm not an expert." I felt a surge of irritation, but it wasn't directed at her. I had the wrong brain for this task, and so did she. We needed a linguist. We could look at that lattice work script for ages, and the most original thought I would have is that it resembled the sharp branching of hard coral. To the surveyor, it might resemble the rough tributaries of a vast river. Eventually, though, I was able to reconstruct fragments of a handful of some of the variants. "Why should I rest when wickedness exists in the world? God's love shines on anyone who understands the limits of endurance and allows forgiveness. Chosen for the service of a higher power." If the main thread formed a kind of dark, incomprehensible sermon, then the fragments shared an affinity with that purpose without the heightened syntax. Did they come from longer accounts of some sort, possibly from members of prior expeditions? If so, for what purpose? And over how many years? But all such questions would be for later, in the light of the surface. Mechanically, like a golem, I just took photographs of key phrases. Even as the surveyor thought I was clicking pictures of blank wall or off-center shots of the main fungal words, to put some distance between myself and whatever I might think about these variants. While the main scrawl continued and continued to unnerve, "In the black water with the sun shining at midnight, those fruit shall come ripe, and in the darkness of that which is golden shall split open to reveal the revelation of the fatal softness in the earth." Those words defeated me somehow. I took samples as we went, but half-heartedly. All of these tiny remnants I was stuffing into glass tubes with tweezers, what would they tell me? Not much, I felt. Sometimes you get a sense of when the truth of things will not be revealed by microscopes. Soon, too, the sound of the heartbeat through the walls became so loud to me I stopped to put in earplugs to muffle its beat, choosing a moment while the surveyor's attention lay elsewhere. Bemasked, half deaf, for different reasons, we continued our descent. It should have been me who noticed the change, not her, but after an hour of downward progress, the surveyor stopped on the steps below me. "Do you think the words on the wall are becoming fresher?"
Fresher?
More recent.
I just stared at her for a moment. I had become acclimated to the situation, had done my best to pretend to be the kind of impartial observer who simply catalogues details. But I felt all of that hard-won distance slipping away.
Turn off your light, I suggested, as I did the same.
The surveyor hesitated. After my show of impulsiveness earlier, it would be some time before she trusted me again. Not the kind of trust that responded unthinkingly to a request to plunge us into darkness. But she did it. The truth was, I had purposefully left my gun in its belt holster, and she could have extinguished me in a moment with her assault rifle, with one fluid motion pulling on the strap and freeing it from her shoulder. This premonition of violence made little rational sense, and yet it came to me too easily, almost as if placed in my mind by outside forces. In the dark, as the tower's heartbeat still throbbed against my eardrums, the letters, the words, swayed as the walls trembled with their breathing, and I saw that indeed the words seemed more active, the colors brighter, the strobing more intense than I remembered it from levels above. It was an even more noticeable effect than if the words had been written in ink with a fountain pen. The bright, wet slickness of the new. Standing there in that impossible place, I said it before the surveyor could, to own it. Something below us is writing this script. Something below us may still be in the process of writing this script. We were exploring an organism that might contain a mysterious second organism, which was itself using yet other organisms to write words on the wall. It made the overgrown pool of my youth seem simplistic, one-dimensional. We turned our lights back on. I saw fear in the surveyor's eyes, but also a strange determination. I have no idea what she saw in me.
"Why did you say something?" she asked.
I didn't understand.
Why did you say something rather than someone? Why can't it be someone?
I just shrugged.
Get out your gun,
the surveyor said, a hint of disgust in her voice masking some deeper emotion. I did as I was told because it didn't really matter to me. But holding the gun made me feel clumsy and odd, as if it were the wrong reaction to what might confront us. Whereas I had taken the lead to this point, now it seemed as if we had switched roles, and the nature of our exploration changed as a result. Apparently, we had just established a new protocol. We stopped documenting the words and organisms on the wall. We walked much more swiftly, our attention focused on interpreting the darkness in front of us. We spoke in whispers, as if we might be overheard. I went first, with the surveyor covering me from behind, until the curves, where she went first and I followed. At no point did we speak of turning back. The psychologist watching over us might as well have been thousands of miles away. We were charged with the nervous energy of knowing there might be some answer below us, a living, breathing answer. At least the surveyor may have thought of it in those terms. She couldn't feel or hear the beating of the walls, but as we progressed, even I could not see the writer of those words in my mind. All I could see was what I had seen when I had stared back at the border on our way to base camp, a fuzzy white blankness. Yet still, I knew it could not be human.
Why?
For a very good reason, one the surveyor finally noticed. Another 20 minutes into our descent.
"There's something on the floor," she said.
Yes, there was something on the floor. For a long time now, the steps had been covered in a kind of residue. I hadn't stopped to examine it because I hadn't wanted to unnerve the surveyor, uncertain if she would ever come to see it. The residue covered a distance from the edge of the left wall to about 2 feet from the right wall. This meant it filled a space on the steps about 8 or 9 feet wide.
"Let me take a look,"
I said, ignoring her quivering finger. I knelt,
Turning to train my helmet light on the upper steps behind me, the surveyor walked up to stare over my shoulder. The residue sparkled with a kind of subdued golden shimmer, shot through with flakes, red, like dried blood. It seemed partially reflective. I probed it with a pen. "It's slightly viscous, like slime," I said, "and about half an inch deep over the steps." The overall impression was of something sliding down the stairs.
"What about those marks?"
the surveyor asked, leaning forward to point again. She was whispering, which seemed useless to me, and her voice had a catch in it. But every time I noticed her becoming more panicky, I found it made me calmer. I studied the marks for a moment, sliding, perhaps, or dragged, but slowly enough to reveal much more in the residue left behind. The marks she had pointed to were oval and about a foot long by half a foot wide. Six of them were splayed over the steps in two rows. A flurry of indentations inside these shapes resembled the marks left by cilia. About 10 inches outside of these tracks, encircling them, were two lines. This irregular double circle undulated out and then in again, almost like the hem of a skirt. Beyond this hem were faint indicators of further waves, as of some force emanating from a central body that had left a mark. It resembled most closely the lines left in sand as the surf recedes during low tide, except that something had blurred the lines and made them fuzzy, like charcoal drawings. This discovery fascinated me. I could not stop staring at the trail, the cilia marks. I imagined such a creature might correct for the slant of the stairs, much like a geostabilizing camera would correct for bumps in a track.
"Have you ever seen anything like that?" the surveyor asked.
"No," I replied. With an effort, I bit back a more caustic response. "No, I never have." Certain trilobites, snails, and worms left trails, simple by comparison, but vaguely similar. I was confident no one back in the world had ever seen a trail this complex or this large.
"What about that?"
the surveyor indicated a step a little farther up. I trained a light on it and saw a suggestion of a boot print in the residue.
"Just one of our own boots."
So mundane in comparison, so boring. The light on her helmet shuddered from side to side as she shook her head.
"No. See?"
She pointed out my boot prints and hers. This imprint was from a third set and headed back up the steps.
"You're right," I said.
"That's another person. Down here not long ago."
The surveyor started cursing.
At the time, we didn't think to look for more sets of boot prints. According to the records we have been shown, the first expedition reported nothing unusual in Area X, just pristine, empty wilderness. After the second and third expeditions did not return and their fate became known, the expeditions were shut down for a time. When they began again, it was using carefully chosen volunteers who might at least know a measure of the full risk. Since then, some expeditions had been more successful than others. The 11th expedition in particular had been difficult. And personally difficult for me, with regard to a fact about which I have not been entirely honest thus far. My husband was on the 11th expedition as a medic. He had never wanted to be a doctor, had always wanted to be in first response or working in trauma. A triage nurse in the field, as he put it. He had been recruited for Area X by a friend who remembered him from when they had both worked for the Navy before he switched over to ambulance service. At first he hadn't said yes, had been unsure, but over time they convinced him. It caused a lot of strife between us, although we already had many difficulties. I know this information might not be hard for anyone to find out, but I have hoped that in reading this account you might find me a credible, objective witness, not someone who volunteered for Area X because of some other event unconnected to the purpose of the expeditions. And, in a sense, this is still true, and my husband's status as a member of an expedition is in many ways irrelevant to why I signed up. But how could I not be affected by Area X, if only through him? One night, about a year after he had headed for the border, as I lay alone in bed, I heard someone in the kitchen, armed with a baseball bat. I left the bedroom and turned on all the lights in the house. I found my husband next to the refrigerator, still dressed in his expedition clothes, drinking milk until it flowed down his chin and neck, eating leftovers furiously. I was speechless. I could only stare at him as if he were a mirage, and if I moved or said anything, he would dissipate into nothing or less than nothing. We sat in the living room, him on the sofa and me in a chair opposite. I needed some distance from this sudden apparition. He did not remember how he had left Area X, did not remember the journey home at all. He had only the vaguest recollection of the expedition itself. There was an odd calm about him, punctured only by moments of remote panic when, in asking him what had happened, he recognized that his amnesia was unnatural. Gone from him, too, seemed to be any memory of how our marriage had begun to disintegrate well before our arguments over his leaving for Area X. He contained within him now the very distance he had in so many subtle and not-so-subtle ways accused me of in the past. After a time, I couldn't take it any longer. I took off his clothes, made him shower, then led him into the bedroom and made love to him with me on top. I was trying to reclaim remnants of the man I remembered, the one who, so unlike me, was outgoing and impetuous and always wanted to be of use, the man who had been a passionate recreational sailor and for 2 weeks out of the year went with friends to the coast to go boating. I could find none of that in him now. The whole time he was inside me, he looked up at my face with an expression that told me he did remember me, but only through a kind of fog. It helped for a while, though. It made him more real, allowed me to pretend, but only for a while. I only had him in my life again for about 24 hours. They came for him the next evening, and once I went through the long, drawn-out process of receiving security clearance, I visited him in the observation facility right up until the end. That antiseptic place where they tested him and tried without success to break through both his calm and his amnesia. He would greet me like an old friend, an anchor of sorts, to make sense of his existence, but not like a lover. I confess I went because I had hopes that there remained some spark of the man I'd once known, but I never really found it. Even the day I was told he had been diagnosed with inoperable systemic cancer, my husband stared at me with a slightly puzzled expression on his face. He died 6 months later. During all that time, I could never get beyond the mask, could never find the man I had known inside of him. Not through my personal interactions with him, not through eventually watching the interviews with him and the other members of the expedition, all of whom died of cancer as well. Whatever had happened in Area X, he had not come back. Not really. Even farther down into the darkness we went, and I had to ask myself if any of this had been experienced by my husband. I did not know how my infection changed things. Was I on the same journey, or had he found something completely different? If similar, how had his reactions been different, and how had that changed what happened next? The path of slime grew thicker, and we could now tell that the red flecks were living organisms discharged by whatever lay below, for they wriggled in the viscous layer. The color of the substance had intensified so that it resembled a sparkling golden carpet set out for us to tread upon on our way to some strange yet magnificent banquet. "Should we go back?" the surveyor would say, or I would say, and the other would say, just around the next corner, just a little farther, and then we will go back. It was a test of a fragile trust. It was a test of our curiosity and fascination, which walked side by side with our fear. A test of whether we preferred to be ignorant or unsafe. The feel of our boots as we advanced step by careful step through that viscous discharge, the way in which the stickiness seemed to mire us even as we managed to keep moving, would eventually end in inertia, we knew, if we pushed it too far. But then the surveyor rounded a corner ahead of me and recoiled into me, shoved me back up the steps, and I let her. "There's something down there," she whispered in my ear. "Something like a body or a person." I didn't point out that a body could be a person. "Is it writing words on the wall?" "No, slumped down by the side of the wall. I only caught a glimpse." Her breathing came quick and shallow against her mask. "A man or a woman?" I asked.
"I thought it was a person," she said, ignoring my question. "I thought it was a person. I thought it was."
Bodies were one thing. No amount of training could prepare you for encountering a monster. But we could not climb back out of the tower without first investigating this new mystery. We could not. I grabbed her by the shoulders, made her look at me. "You said it's like a person sitting down against the side of the wall. That's not whatever we've been tracking."
"This has to do with the other boot print. You know that.
We can risk taking a look at whatever this is, and then we'll go back up. This is as far as we go, no matter what we find, I promise." The surveyor nodded. The idea of this being the extent of it, of not going farther down, was enough to steady her. "Just get through this last thing, and you'll see the sunlight soon." We started back down. The steps seemed particularly slippery now, even though it might have been our jitters, and we walked slowly, using the blank slate of the right wall to keep our balance. The tower was silent, holding its breath, its heartbeat suddenly slow and far more distant than before. Or perhaps I could only hear the blood rushing through my head. Turning the corner, I saw the figure and shone my helmet light on it. If I'd hesitated a second longer, I never would have had the nerve. It was the body of the anthropologist, slumped against the left-hand wall, her hands in her lap, her head down, as if in prayer, something green spilling out from her mouth. Her clothing seemed oddly fuzzy, indistinct. A faint golden glow arose from her body, almost imperceptible. I imagined the surveyor could not see it at all. In no scenario could I imagine the anthropologist alive. All I could think was, the psychologist lied to us, and suddenly the pressure of her presence far above, guarding the entrance, was pressing down on me in an intolerable way. I put out a palm to the surveyor, indicating that she should stay where she was, behind me, and I stepped forward, light pointed down into the darkness. I walked past the body, far enough to confirm the stairs below were empty, then hurried back up. "Keep watch while I take a look at the body," I said. I didn't tell her I had sensed a faint echoing suggestion of something much farther below, moving slowly.
"It is a body,"
the surveyor said. Perhaps she had expected something far stranger. Perhaps she thought the figure was just sleeping. "It's the anthropologist," I said, and saw that information register in the tensing of her shoulders. Without another word, she brushed past me to take up a position just beyond the body, assault rifle aimed into the darkness. Gently, I knelt beside the anthropologist. There wasn't much left of her face, and odd burn marks were all over the remaining skin, spilling out from her broken jaw, which looked as though someone had wrenched it open in a single act of brutality, was a torrent of green ash that sat on her chest in a mound. Her hands, palms up in her lap, had no skin left on them, only a kind of gauzy filament and more burn marks. Her legs seemed fused together and half melted, one boot missing and one flung against the wall. Strewn around the anthropologist were some of the same sample tubes I had brought with me. her black box crushed, lay several feet from her body.
"What happened to her?"
the surveyor whispered. She kept taking quick, nervous glances back at me as she stood guard, almost as if whatever had happened wasn't over, as if she expected the anthropologist to come back to horrifying life. I didn't answer her. All I could have said was, "I don't know," a sentence that was becoming a kind of witness to our own ignorance or incompetence, or both. I shone my light on the wall above the anthropologist. For several feet, the script on the wall became erratic, leaping up and dipping down, before regaining its equilibrium. The shadows of the abyss are like the petals of a monstrous flower that shall blossom within the skull and expand the mind beyond what any man can bear.
"I think she interrupted the creator of the script on the wall," I said. "And it did that to her?"
She was pleading with me to find some other explanation. I didn't have one, so I didn't reply, just went back to observing as she stood there, watching me. A biologist is not a detective, but I began to think like a detective. I surveyed the ground to all sides, identifying first my own boot prints on the steps, and then the surveyor's. We had obscured the original tracks, but you could still see traces. First of all, the thing, and no matter what the surveyor might hope, I could not think of it as human, had clearly turned in a frenzy. Instead of the smooth sliding tracks, the slime residue formed a kind of clockwise swirl. The marks of the feet, as I thought of them, elongated and narrowed by the sudden change. But on top of this swirl, I could also see boot prints. I retrieved the one boot, being careful to walk around the edges of the evidence of the encounter. The boot prints in the middle of the swirl were indeed from the anthropologist, and I could follow partial imprints back up the right-hand side of the wall as if she had been hugging it. An image began to form in my mind of the anthropologist creeping down in the dark to observe the creator of the script. The glittering glass tubes strewn around her body made me think that she had hoped to take a sample. But how insane or oblivious! Such a risk, and the anthropologist had never struck me as impulsive or brave. I stood there for a moment, and then backtracked even farther up the stairs, as I motioned to the surveyor, much to her distress, to hold her position. Perhaps if there had been something to shoot, she would have been calmer, but we were left with only what lingered in our imaginations. Another dozen steps up, right where you could still have a slit of a view of the dead anthropologist, I found two sets of boot prints facing each other. One set belonged to the anthropologist. The other was neither mine nor the surveyor's. Something clicked into place, and I could see it all in my head. In the middle of the night, the psychologist had woken the anthropologist, put her under hypnosis, and together they had come to the tower and climbed down this far. At this point, the psychologist had given the anthropologist an order under hypnosis, one that she probably knew was suicidal, and the anthropologist had walked right up to the thing that was writing the words on the wall and tried to take a sample, and died trying, probably in agony. The psychologist had then fled. Certainly, as I walked back down, I could find no trace of her boot prints below that point. Was it pity or empathy that I felt for the anthropologist? Weak, trapped, with no choice. The surveyor waited for me, anxious.
"What did you find?"
"Another person was here with the anthropologist." I told the surveyor my theory.
"But why would the psychologist do that?"
she asked me.
"We were going to all come down here in the morning anyway."
I felt as if I were observing the surveyor from 1,000 miles away. "I have no idea," I said, "but she's been hypnotizing all of us, and not just to give us peace of mind. Perhaps this expedition had a different purpose than what we were told."
"Hypnotism?"
She said the word like it was meaningless.
"How do you know that? How could you possibly know that?"
The surveyor seemed resentful of me or of the theory. I couldn't tell which. but I could understand why.
Because, somehow, I have become impervious to it, I told her. She hypnotized you before we came down here today, to make sure you would do your duty. I saw her do it. I wanted to confess to the surveyor, to tell her how I had become impervious, but believed that that would be a mistake.
And you did nothing? If this is even true?
At least she was considering the possibility of believing me. Perhaps some residue, some fuzziness from the episode had stuck in her mind.
I didn't want the psychologist to know that she couldn't hypnotize me.
And I had wanted to come down here. The surveyor stood there for a moment, considering.
Believe me or don't believe me, I said, but believe this. When we go up there, we need to be ready for anything. We may need to restrain or kill the psychologist because we don't know what she's planning.
Why would she be planning anything?
The surveyor asked. Was that disdain in her voice or just fear again?
Because she must have different orders than the ones we got, I said, as if explaining to a child.
When she did not reply, I took that as a sign that she was beginning to acclimate to the idea.
I'll need to go first, because she can't affect me, and you'll need to wear these. It might help you resist the hypnotic suggestion.
I gave her my extra set of earplugs. She took them hesitantly.
No,
she said.
We'll go up together at the same time.
That isn't wise, I said.
I don't care what it is. You're not going to go up top without me. I'm not waiting there in the dark for you to fix everything.
I thought about that for a moment, then said,
fine. But if I see that she's starting to coerce you, I'll have to stop her.
Or at least try.
If you're right, the surveyor said, if you're telling the truth.
I am.
She ignored me, said,
what about the body?
Did that mean we were agreed? I hoped so. Or maybe she would try to disarm me on the way up. Perhaps the psychologist had already prepared her in this regard.
We leave the anthropologist here. We can't be weighed down. And we also don't know what contaminants we might bring with us.
The surveyor nodded. At least she wasn't sentimental. There was nothing left of the anthropologist in that body, and we both knew it. I was trying very hard not to think of the anthropologist's last moments alive, of the terror she must have felt as she continued trying to perform a task that she had been willed to do by another, even though it meant her own death.
What had she seen? What had she been looking at before it all went dark?
Before we turned back, I took one of the glass tubes strewn around the anthropologist. It contained just a trace of a thick, flesh-like substance that gleamed darkly golden. Perhaps she had gotten a useful sample after all, near the end. As we ascended toward the light, I tried to distract myself. I kept reviewing my training over and over again, searching for a clue, for any scrap of information that might lead to some revelation about our discoveries. But I could find nothing. Could only wonder at my own gullibility in thinking that I had been told anything at all of use. Always the emphasis was on our own capabilities and knowledge base. Always, as I looked back, I could see that there had been an almost willful intent to obscure, to misdirect, disguised as concern that we not be frightened or overwhelmed. The map had been the first form of misdirection. For what was a map but a way of emphasizing some things and making other things invisible? Always we were directed to the map, to memorizing the details on the map. Our instructor, who remained nameless to us, drilled us for 6 long months on the position of the lighthouse relative to the base camp, the number of miles from one ruined patch of houses to another, the number of miles of coastline we would be expected to explore— almost always in the context of the lighthouse, not the base camp. We became so comfortable with that map, with the dimensions of it, and the thought of what it contained, that it stopped us from asking why, or even what. Why this stretch of coast? What might lie inside the lighthouse? Why was the camp set back into the forest, far from the lighthouse, but fairly close to the tower, which of course did not exist on the map? And had the base camp always been there? what lay beyond the map. Now that I knew the extent of the hypnotic suggestion that had been used on us, I realized that the focus on the map might have been itself an embedded cue, that if we did not ask questions, it was because we were programmed not to ask questions, that the lighthouse, representative or actual,